Joining me in the studio today is Michael Sharp. Hiya, Michael.
Hi, Joe.
Michael's going to be reviewing Neil Mukherjee's The Lives of Others. It was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2014. Tell us a little about it. I'm afraid I know nothing about this one, Michael. I'll be relying totally on, okay. On your...
Well, it's Neil Mukherjee, as his name indicates, is Indian by birth. He was born in Calcutta. He now lives in London. This is, in fact, his second novel. He wrote an earlier one, which apparently fits in with this, although I have to admit I've never read it. But this particular book was, as you say, was nominated for the shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2014. And it's been very well reviewed. It's a big book. It's
quite a few pages there, isn't it?
It's over 500 pages. Yeah, it's fairly dense writing in some ways. It's published by Vintage. It came out and it tells the story. It's set in the late 1960s, or the majority of it is set in the late 1960s, but there are some flashbacks into some earlier events, and at the end there's a couple of epilogues as to giving you an indication of what happens to some of the characters subsequently.
Very good.
It starts, the first chapter of the book, which is actually referred to as a prologue, is set in 1966, and it details the... what happened to a Indian peasant, Nital Das, who is very poor, finds himself in a position where he can't feed his family, and is driven so distracted by this that he actually kills his family and kills himself, commits suicide. This is just a prologue to sort of set the scene for the book.
Is that a fictional?
No, I think it's that's fictional.
Right.
As far as I know, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it is.
Right.
But no, the book is fiction, but it's set, you know, in the 60s, around the time of real events. The characters are from a large family, the Ghosh family, G-H-O-S-H, who are very much a traditional, quite well-to-do Indian family living in Calcutta.
Yeah.
They live in a very large house. It's so large that it can accommodate three generations of the family.
All at once, my goodness.
The father, or the father of the whole family, is what's his name? Prafulanath.
Right.
And he was born in 1898 and married in the 1920s. He had children. He's four sons and one daughter, all of whom were born in the 20s and early 30s. And they, in turn, then grew up, got married in the 40s and 50s. And
so
they
we're going through the period of British colonial rule.
Yeah, during the period of British colonial rule, up to 1947. So they got married in the 40s and 50s. And they now, at the time the book is set in the late 60s, they all now have the third generation of children, the oldest of whom are just out of their teens, their early 20s, but the others are teenagers or even younger. So, but the three generations of the family all live in the same house. What has happened, of course, is that it's set against the background of India having become independent in 1947. And not only India independent, but of course India was the what had been referred to as India was split into India and Pakistan. In India for the mainly the Hindus, and Pakistan for the Muslim generation.
What year did that take place?
47.
Oh, it acted in 47.
Yeah, 1947.
Right.
It was just after the war. And so that has happened, and that has obviously had an effect on all sorts of family life and on business and whatever. The Ghoshes have been quite a well-to-do family. The founding father set up or got involved in a paper mill business. He had a very thriving set of paper mills, very well-to-do. But the business is now declining. It was affected, as a lot of things were, by the separation of India and Pakistan, because some of the mills they own were in the part of the country that became Pakistan, so they have no control or involvement in them. And the other mills are not doing as well as they once did for one reason or another.
Yeah.
So you have this background of the family gradually moving from being a very well-to-do family to having certain trials and tribulations. You also have a certain amount of conflict between the generations. The father and mother, the original father and mother, are getting old, no longer able to take a very active part in anything. The sons, the four sons and one daughter, obviously live different lives. They've all grown up, they've married, and they've brought their wives into the family house, and they've now children. But their world is, you know, different to their father's. They've all been involved and brought into the business in one way or another. But they don't always agree with the father on the way that the business should be run. He has ideas, they have ideas.
That's right, that's
and
right.
Things don't always work out. Then, being the 1960s, the firm also suffers labour troubles and industrial unrest.
Yeah, industry would have been changing in India.
Everything was changing. India was changing, and it's very much set against, and this is mentioned several times, that the background of what was colonialism and, the effects, the ongoing effects of what had been the British Empire for years. I mean, it's
Tell me, I'm just wondering, as did this with the emergence of a new sort of India ruled by themselves and with their industry changing and that, is there any sense of uncertainty about the future?
Well,
a sort of a hankering to the old past for what
it's very much. I mean, that's one of the things that's running through the book. I mean, there is a quote at one stage just on the issue of the British leaving. There's a quote at one stage that one of the main characters said, "The British left our country 20 years ago, but their handiwork will remain forever." So you have this. But also you have the whole traditional Indian system, the caste system and so on, which affects their lives hugely. And this is beginning to break down. I mean, obviously now we're 50 years later, it's even further broken down, but it's still there in some respects.
The
but by the 1960s, it was
prevalent.
Beginning to break down, and you got, this is where the conflicts between the parents, the children, and particularly the grandchildren, who are a completely different generation.
Right.
So the traditional role was that basically you had a very traditional approach to women. Marriages were arranged. Dowries were paid.
Yes.
And so all the sons got married in this way. There's four sons, one daughter. The daughter is not particularly pretty individual. She's dark-skinned, much darker than normal. And she also has an unfortunate cross-eyed or eye defect.
Yes,
so she's not particularly attractive looking.
Good, isn't it? Even those sort of things are viewed very differently, aren't they? I mean, slight disabilities
and despite their best efforts, they don't succeed in finding a husband for her. So at the time that in the 1960s, when the story is set, she's now in her 30s, still living in the family home, with all the brothers and their families, and realizing that she's going to be there as a spinster, as their aunt, and she this plays out in terms of jealousy. She's particularly antipathetic to the wife of one of her brothers, who she regards as a much lower caste. He's regarded as having married beneath himself, even though it was an arranged marriage. But even so, she wasn't entirely happy with it. So she's,
there's friction.
There's friction there, and there's little acts of revenge, like she pours makeup. She goes in and gets at the other woman's saris and pours makeup all over them, then engineers it so that one of the younger daughters will be blamed. So all this is going on, and then to add into the mix, a huge change that the eldest grandson, who is the eldest son of the eldest son, Supratik, he's now 21, 22. He becomes very much a revolutionary. He's affected by the sort of Maoist doctrine that is sweeping through the world, and particularly India at that time. Next door to my, it centres on there was a Naxalite movement which did exist. This was after a village where in Calcutta's in West Bengal. That's the area of India. And there was a particular village there where a Maoist revolutionary front started. So it has got supporters from various parts of the country, young people who've joined the Communist Party, the Maoist section of the Communist Party. And of course, there's frictions between the Marxist-Leninist Communist Party and the Maoist Communist Party. Supratik anyway decides to row in with the Maoists, and he and a couple of his friends then leave Calcutta and go and live in the rice fields with the peasants in their villages, and trying to foment revolution or organise a revolution. And he just literally walks out of the family home one night without a buyer leave and mentioning to anyone. And so the...
Is he married just out of a personal interest?
No, he's just a young man. But he walks out, much to the grief of particularly his mother, who really can't take this at all, that he's just walked out. And he just goes, you know, leaves a note saying, I can't stay here anymore, and disappears. But the way this is dealt with in the book is that for the first 10 or 12 chapters, for about two-thirds of the book, every chapter is effectively two parts. That the first part is describing what's happening to the family in Calcutta and the members of it and the things that are going on there.
Yes.
And then the second part is in the form of a letter that Supratik is writing, a report that he's writing to somebody. Right. You never know who. It's just a report that he's writing to on what he's doing and his activities with his friends and with the peasant farmers in the field, and you know, the grinding poverty that they're suffering and the unfairness of the system.
Is the whole
landlords.
Story coming from him as the narrator, is it?
No, not the whole story. There's no narrator as such. It's just written in the These sections are written in the form of a letter from him to somebody, but you never know who, or a report. The other chapters about the family just describe what is happening.
Life in general.
In the standard third-person approach. So this is what's going on. It's not that there are any huge cataclysmic events, although things do develop in Supratik eventually. I mean, as was the norm with this attempts at revolution, that he's not particularly successful. Eventually he's forced to flee from police activity, get back to Calcutta, but he continues whatever work he's doing there, and eventually, of course, falls foul of the police and is arrested, and sort of comes to a sad end, as you might expect.
Yeah.
So you know, it's just the, you know, the description of the family, things breaking down, the whole approach to that they had tradition. You know, that the increasingly the younger children are not following the tradition that they see. Supratik has there's two. He's one of two sons. He has a younger brother. He goes down the Maoist revolutionary route. His younger brother becomes a drug addict and is just off. You know, in a world of his own most of the time, or a drug afflicted world of his own, listening to music of the Grateful Dead and things like that, pop music. Yeah, so you got this conflict of Western civilization, right. Music, clothes, all impinging on the traditional Indian way of life.
Modernism versus
and all this is beautifully described. Now it's not the easiest book to read. It's right. It's quite dense and takes a while to get into it, but it does beautifully describe what's going on. And particularly, you know, there's great descriptions of clothes, of food, of the house. You know, Mukherjee has a talent for...
Did you find yourself seeping into
the other thing, I mean, at the start of the book, they give you a family tree, you know, in fact is very necessary because... I found myself, you know, for the first few hundred pages, you're thumbing back to see now which is this, what's this relationship, you know, because you have the grandfather, the grandmother, the fathers, the sons, the daughters, the
I would find
wives.
That myself if a book's early on heavy with you know, top heavy with names, you do, you know, it's hard to get all the connections, you know.
It's hard, and it's particularly difficult with this because, of course, in Indian, traditional Indian society, they don't, they have particular, not quite pet words, not other phrases, but they you know, you have a word that you address your elder sister or you address your aunt, you know, so these terms are used as well, you know,
terms of familiarity.
Terms of familiarity,
of course, yes.
You know, that they use. So, you know, you have to sort of be aware of these and pick these up so you know who's actually involved in the conversation or who they're talking about. Now there is
how do you
gradually get to them, and again he gives a directory of these at the end. And he also gives a glossary. I mean, obviously there are a lot of words to describe, you know, food, drink, everyday items, but there are particular words that wouldn't necessarily be familiar to English language speakers. So there's a glossary of these terms in it, so you have to sort of be conscious of all of this, as I said, in the first few hundred pages you find there's a certain amount of thumbing back to check, you know, who's that and what's this and so on. But once you sort of get used to that, you do get drawn into it, and it is a wonderful picture of a world that is changing, a family that is changing, young man sort of rebelling against it, being put down, and then you have the relationships. I mean, obviously it's a big house, so they have a huge number of servants. The main servant is a man who's now in his 60s, but he's with them since he was a boy, and he has his own life of sorts in that he has a wife and children, but the wife and children live in a village which he goes and visits for a month every year. But otherwise he's part of this family, but yet when there's, you know, a couple of events in it when it's seen that he is at the end of the day a servant. And then you get the relationship within the family that the youngest son, who's Somnath, who's a bit younger than the other brothers. Most of the others were born in the 20s. He's, you know, 5-6 years younger than the others. And is always regarded as a bit odder than them. He's, in fact, not a particularly nice character at all.
Right.
But he marries and he dies young, largely as a result of his own activities. So the wife is a young widow with two small children. And she's still living in the house. She's given she's allowed to stay in the house, but effectively she's relegated to living in what was really a storeroom. And the food is cooked for the whole family, but she gets sort of, you know, more or less the leftovers of everybody else. And she's almost treated like a servant because that's the way the servants eat. I mean, they all have the same food, but there's magnificent food for the family. And but
she's separate.
And the servants sort of get what's left over, and it may be stale, it may be cast offs, whatever. So you get these this very strong caste system and society, you know, what the society was and what some people maintain it. And there's, I mean, there's one conversation between Supertick, the revolutionary young man, and his mother, and he's railing against, you know, the amount of food that the family have.
Right.
And the mother sort of says, but, you know, that's the way it is. That's the way it's always has been.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he says, no, it's not. It's not for the servants. It's not for the peasants and so
on.
Oh,
yes.
And then
he goes and lives
among the peasants. Right. And you get descriptions not just of what the food that the family have had, but the food he's now eating,
right.
What the peasants eat, which is not sufficient really to... to keep him.
For nourishment.
For nourishment. Yeah, yeah. And yet that they managed to do a very long day's work on it. And he's trying to help them. And he's, of course, suffering because he's hungry. And, of course, the hard work in the fields doesn't suit him at all. But
absolutely.
Excuse me. So it's It doesn't go anywhere that is not unexpected, but it does, you know, beautifully describe these conflicts that arise from time to time.
Are we working towards any particular type of conclusion, or is it?
No, except that it never concludes in that you know, you can detect the breakdown in the family that the, I mean, nobody apart from the younger son, who, as I said, dies in an unusual set of circumstances. I mean, all the characters are still alive, you know, the father, the grandfather, grandmother, the founders of the family, they're quite old. They're well into their 60s and quite handicapped in poor health, but they're still there at the end of the book. Nobody that's, you know, it's told over only about 3 or 4 years from 1960. Well, the initial event happens in 1966, but the main activity is 68 to 70. But then there's a couple of bits of prologues at the end where they describe what happens to one of the youngest son's son, who is only a small boy at the time, in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
Is already showing promise at mathematics.
Right.
And his teacher calls in his mother, of course, who's a widow, and says, you know, what you have is a mathematical genius.
Right.
And they arrange for him, the teacher arranges for him to be taken on at a university in the States, even though he's only, you know, 11, 12 years old.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In the epilogue at the end, you find that this guy has advanced to being a professor of mathematics at the university and is winning international prizes, you know, for his work on prime numbers and so on in mathematics.
There's a mini-series coming here.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about a mini-series.
It sounds like it's got the story.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I think it's...
Just a question. It was originally... It's been published originally in what country...
Oh, it's published in Britain. I mean, he lives in Neil Mukherjee was born in Calcutta, but he's living in London. I presume he's lived in London for some time. It's his second novel. He's still a relatively young man, and it was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. But it's, you know, it's, as I said, it's not the easiest book to read.
Right.
Certainly, initially, you find yourself.
They'll grab you.
But eventually it does. Eventually, it is a marvelous description of a society at a particular point in time when the effects of the empire are still there, effects of colonialism, and most of the characters, of course, were born into that world and lived in it for, in the case of the parents, their whole
certain
growth period, I mean, they, and the building up of their business and so on was all in that time. Mm. The sons were born in the 20s and grew to adulthood in colonialism, whereas the younger children have now been born into an independent India, they don't entirely understand, you know, the traditions of the caste and the
course
and this and the affinity that the characters have, particularly the female characters have with their jewellery, you know, that was very much traditional, that the Indian woman's collection of jewellery was very precious to her. And this has, you know, there are developments in the plot that affect that as well.
Right.
So
suppose are we getting a good insight into Indian culture?
Yes, very much. That's and it. The it's very much. That, it's that very much. Very much an insight into traditional Indian culture and the dress, the food, all the other relationships, arranged marriages, all this thing, the attitude of men to women, and one part of society to another part of society.
Because it has been going through a great deal of social, and cultural challenges.
Yes.
I'm not sure about change, but certainly challenges to.
Well, you got social challenges, and then you were having the political challenges as well. That after independence, you had the. I mean, I remember even in my own lifetime that the India was dominated by what was called the Congress Party. But then in the 60s, you began to as happened the world over, you began to get revolutionary movements, the Maoists, and so on. Whereas these were not particularly successful, you do have nationalist parties and other parties in India. I've said that myself on a visit. That's a good few years ago now. And whereas the Congress Party was hugely dominant for many years, gradually there are now, it's not anything like the same. I mean, the original prime ministers, if you think back to Mrs. Pandit Nehru, who was the original prime minister, and then his daughter, Mrs. Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, who they were prime minister for many years. But, I mean, that sort of dynasty has gone away, and there's now a greater multiplicity of parties, contesting general elections holding control in the various parts of the country. Of course, India, it's been such a large country and such a large population.
Very diverse
population in different parts of the country. I mean, this is very much, it's Indian, but it's very much the tradition of West Bengal, which was a very significant part of India, whereas other parts of the country, the south around Madras and over on the west coast, Bombay, and in the north you have Delhi.
And actually, I remember talking to, working with some Indian guys, and them telling me about how, like you mentioned, the colour of the darker skinned wife earlier on. I remember the guy telling me about, he was from the southeast of India.
Yeah.
And he was particularly dark himself, and he was talking about how he could be identified from his area and possibly even his caste and whatnot.
Yes.
And it was fascinating, just hearing it, their sort of social issues talked about, So you enjoyed it?
I enjoyed it. As I said, it took a little bit of effort to read it. It is 500 pages long, and as I say, for the first couple of hundred pages, you're being drawn in. Well, at least I was. It is, you have to keep concentrating on who's which character, and who's married to whom, and whose son is this and whose daughter is this, and so on.
Oh, well, good brain exercise.
But it does capture, and the heat of the sun, and the weather, particularly in when Supertick is out in the fields, and the effect of the monsoon turning the red earth to green, and in the they're this big house, and the roof, of course, in the hottest weather, the roof gets very, very hot, such that you literally don't go out on the roof.
I just get the land of contrast coming from you. That's the vibe of
it. It is.
Well, that's Neil Mukherjee's The Lives of Others. Described as unforgettable by the Daily Telegraph. Terrifying delights, says The Guardian. And our man here, Michael Sharp, what did you say, Michael?
I'd say it's if you can stick with it, I certainly would find it rewarding, and if you're in any way interested in the history of that part of the world and tradition and the conflicts, certainly it's a beautiful description of that. And as I said, there's marvelous descriptions of everything, food, clothing, music, countryside, and even some quite harrowing descriptions of death, and particularly torture. I mean, Supertick is at one stage is arrested by the police and tortured, and there's a chapter, dealing with what they do with them, which is quite harrowing. It's difficult. I found it quite difficult to read. If you're anyway squeamish, you wouldn't be gone on reading it. But
when you pique my interest, I think I'll have to mug you on the way out and take it home with me and get a read out.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks very much, Michael, for that. Thank you.